Stay tuned for Africa News Tonight, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
New Israel-Hamas fighting as Cairo talks breakdown and trying to verify video showing journalists beheading. I'm Bob Doty reporting from Washington. Israel and Palestinian fighters in Gaza carried out dozens of attacks on each other Wednesday as ceasefire talks in Egypt broke down. Palestinian authorities say at least 11 people were killed in the latest round of violence. Hamas says the wife and child of its military leader, Mohammed Deif, are among the dead. VOA Scott Bob reports from Jerusalem.
The Israeli military said it launched airstrikes against militant targets in Gaza after at least 40 rockets were fired from Gaza into Israel. The Israeli military reported rockets landed near the southern cities of Beersheba and Ashkelon and the central city, Jerusalem. Government spokesman Mark Regev accused the Hamas group that controls Gaza of breaking the truce.
This is the 11th ceasefire that Hamas has either rejected or violated.
Hamas officials denied their group had launched any attacks against Israel. Spokesman Sami Abu Zuhri accused Israel of violating the truce. Scott Bob, VOA News, Jerusalem.
U.S. officials are working to confirm the authenticity of a video that Islamic State militants say shows the beheading of an American journalist as a message for the United States to stop intervening in Iraq. U.S. National Security Council spokeswoman Caitlin Hayden said late Tuesday that if the video purportedly showing the beheading of James Foley is genuine, the U.S. is appalled by the brutal murder. Foley's mother, Diane, urged the Islamic State fighters to not harm any more hostages, saying that they are innocents who have nothing to do with U.S. government actions in Iraq and Syria. This is VOA News. Police in Liberia's capital have fired tear gas at protesters who are upset that the government placed a quarantine on their neighborhood to fight the spread of Ebola. Residents in Monrovia's West Point area shouted and threw stones at security forces after they surrounded the area Wednesday. Some people complained they had received no warning of the newly imposed quarantine and expressed concern that they would not be able to get food. President Ellen Johnson Sirleaf ordered the quarantine for the West Point neighborhood Tuesday. In an address late Tuesday, she said the measures were meant to save lives. French President François Hollande has called for an international conference to discuss the militant group Islamic State that has seized territory in Iraq and Syria. Mr. Hollande told the Le Monde newspaper Wednesday, there needs to be a global strategy to address the group that he called well-structured, well-financed, and in possession of sophisticated weapons. The United States has been carrying out airstrikes against the militants, including operations Tuesday that backed Iraqi and Kurdish forces as they pushed forward toward the northern city of Tikrit. The Iraqi government, whose forces buckled under a recent extremist offensive, has made the recapture of Tikrit a priority. U.S. Attorney General Eric Holder is expected in Ferguson, Missouri on Wednesday following a quieter night in the U.S. town that saw violent protests after the shooting death of an unarmed black teenager by a white police officer. Holder is due to meet with community leaders, FBI investigators, and federal civil rights officials to discuss Brown's August 9th death, which sparked daily protests and allegations of systemic discrimination and racism. Also Wednesday, a grand jury investigating the shooting is expected to begin hearing evidence on the case. Somali security forces have arrested one of the country's most powerful pirate chiefs, who once hijacked giant vessels, earning him multi-million dollar ransoms, security sources said Tuesday. Mohamed Gardfanji was seized late Sunday in the capital Mogadishu, along with several of his well-armed bodyguards, according to foreign and Somali security sources. There was no official confirmation from the internationally backed government. Pakistan's parliament met Wednesday as thousands of protesters gathered outside, calling for Prime Minister Nawaz Sharif to step down. Protesters broke down police barricades late Tuesday and entered into the housing area, the parliament, and the other government buildings. At least 35 people died Wednesday when landslides buried dozens of houses on the outskirts of Hiroshima, Japan. Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe ordered several hundred soldiers to the area to help with rescue efforts. From Washington, I'm Bob Doty.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Yehizu Heeb, and coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight.
Liberia has quarantined two areas around the capital, Monrovia, and declared a nationwide curfew as authorities scramble to stop the spread of Ebola. The disease has killed at least 433 people there, the highest death toll in any nation affected by the outbreak.
That's VOA's Anne Luke reporting. Details coming up.
Also in the news, Human Rights Watch says South Sudan's army used child soldiers during recent fighting against opposition forces in violation of international law.
We'll have these stories, plus the sunny side of sports with Sunny Young, music from Burundi, and our daily features. So stay with us. There's lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight.
Our top story this hour, Liberia has quarantined two areas around the capital, Monrovia, and declared a nationwide curfew as authorities scramble to stop the spread of Ebola. The disease has killed at least 433 people there, the highest death toll in any nation affected by the outbreak. The new emergency measures have heightened tensions in Monrovia. VOA's Anne Look has more with reporting from Monrovia by Prince Collins.
Police fired tear gas Wednesday to disperse a crowd in the West Point area of Monrovia, a suburb that had been placed under quarantine just hours earlier. The people were trying to get past a newly erected police checkpoint. A West Point resident who was in the crowd told VOA by phone that he had been trying to go to a nearby market to buy food. The residents of West Point were not given advance notice of the quarantine declared late Tuesday. President Ellen Johnson Sirleaf said West Point and Dolo Town, also outside the capital, are now, quote, areas of intensity for Ebola and will be quarantined under full security watch.
This means there will be no movements in and out of those areas.
West Point is where an angry mob raided an Ebola treatment center during the weekend. Looters walked away with bedding and hospital materials that could have been contaminated. The government says the 37 patients who fled the center during the attack have since been found. But the incident thrust the capital into a panic. The government blamed the attack on a, quote, misunderstanding among locals about the purpose of the center, which was to observe suspected Ebola cases. Effective Wednesday, Liberia is under a nationwide curfew from 9 p.m. to 6 a.m. President Sirleaf said existing emergency measures, like the quarantine of several affected border counties, have not been enough.
We have been unable to control the spread due to continued denials, cultural bearing practices, disregard for the advice of health workers, and disrespect for the warnings by the government. As a result, and due to the large population concentration, the disease has spread widely in Monrovia and its environs.
Liberians continue to complain of shortcomings in the government's response. Residents of Monrovia and other affected parts of the country say they are reporting dead bodies to authorities as instructed, but it is still taking days for burial teams to arrive to pick them up. Ebola is transmitted through close contact with a sick person's bodily fluids. Corpses of Ebola victims are especially contagious, so the government has forbidden private burials. Public health experts tell VOA that poor communication and challenges in the field are heightening public anxiety and risk undercutting confidence in the authorities. Anne Look, VOA News, Dakar.
The chief medical officer in Sierra Leone's Kinimi district says the nation's Ebola epidemic began when infected patients from Guinea crossed the eastern border seeking a cure from a rural herbalist. Mohamed Vandi told the French news agency AFP a woman in Sokoma village claimed she could cure Ebola. However, Vandi said when the healer herself died of Ebola, her mourners helped to spread the disease among the villages of Kisii tribal chiefdoms by June 17. The virus had reached Kinema, a city of 190,000. The World Health Organization says at least 365 people have died of Ebola in Sierra Leone.
The three West African countries at the center of the Ebola outbreak have at least one thing in common: weak healthcare systems. Experts say that prevented Guinea, Liberia, and Sierra Leone from responding quickly and effectively to the epidemic. VOA's Joe DiCapua reports.
The international nonprofit NGO, Management Sciences for Health, says that strong health systems are key to a successful response to Ebola and other infectious diseases. Dan Nelson is the organization's expert on fragile states. He describes what's often lacking in countries with weak healthcare systems.
They tend not to have sufficient qualified personnel. They tend not to have routine data collection systems that are reliable, so it's difficult to get good planning. Poor facilities, lack of equipment, lack of supplies, lack of essential medicines.
He says there's a reason many developing countries have not invested in their health systems.
Many of them are financially strapped to begin with, especially those in conflict or post-conflict. During times of conflict, generally resources can be siphoned off for the war effort or for general security. Also, these tend to be poorer countries. So if you look at basic economic indicators, you're going to find that most of the fragile states are indeed quite poor to begin with and have a hard time funding, even in the best of times, from health facilities.
What's more, Nelson says, these countries often lack infrastructure for educating and training health personnel. Also, many health workers come under attack, not only in conflict situations, but in the Ebola-affected countries. Many have been threatened by residents of towns and villages when they have attempted to deal with the Ebola outbreak. Much of that has been blamed on fear and stigma surrounding the disease. There's also a shortage of health workers in developing countries. Many leave for better jobs in richer nations. In Guinea, Liberia, and Sierra Leone, many health workers themselves have been infected by the Ebola virus.
Generally, the healthcare workers are on the front line. Sometimes they're insufficiently trained to deal with a situation like this, and sometimes they have insufficient equipment. You see the WHO, CDC people coming in with these contamination suits in which they are completely blocked from any threat of contamination, and even with those suits sometimes you still find some contamination. Sometimes it's just bad luck. Despite having the suit, you could still have a needle stick that would puncture the suit and you could still become infected.
The Management Sciences for Health official says in building a strong healthcare system, it's very important to get women involved. Also, the system needs to be resilient, strong enough to withstand shocks and trauma. The Ebola outbreak and natural disasters are two examples.
Especially in Africa, where most of my experience is, you find that there's an amazing amount of creativity and problem solving. They're used to working in situations with very poor infrastructure, and they're used to being able to get things done, but they do need resources.
He says it's important to work with the local population in building health systems. He says when bringing in outside medical personnel to help in a crisis, they should be made familiar with the local culture and customs. One of the problems health workers have faced in the Ebola outbreak is a denial among some that the disease even exists. Nelson says targeted education campaigns can help. This includes the use of local radio in rural areas. Joe DiCapua, VOA News, Washington.
And from the Center for Disease Control, here are some suggestions to prevent the Ebola virus from spreading. Avoid physical contact with people showing symptoms like continuous high fever, red eyes, vomiting, and stomach ache. Wash hands thoroughly and frequently, including under the fingernails. Use soap and clean water. Use hand sanitizer if soap is not available. Use gloves when taking care of infected patients. Cook all animal food and byproducts thoroughly and avoid bushmeat. Wear protective clothing and gloves when handling animals, and do not touch anyone who has died from Ebola.
Coming up on 15 minutes past the hour, this is Africa News Tonight on The Voice of America. China's Foreign Minister Wang Yi has called for an immediate ceasefire in the 8-month conflict in South Sudan. The call came during a meeting yesterday in Beijing with South Sudan Foreign Minister Barnaba Marielle Benjamin. China has major interest in oil production in the country and has been actively urging an end to the fighting. Both sides in the conflict have failed to honor earlier ceasefire pledges. They also failed to meet last week's deadline to create an interim government. UN humanitarian officials say the South Sudan conflict has displaced more than 1.5 million people. Thousands of civilians have been killed, raped, or wounded based on their ethnicity. Meanwhile, the international human rights organization Human Rights Watch says South Sudan's army used child soldiers during recent fighting against opposition forces in violation of international law. HRW reports the government used child soldiers in renewed fighting in mid-August in Bentiu, the capital of Unity State. Eyewitnesses who fled the fighting told HRW that they saw dozens of children in military uniform armed with assault rifles and deployed with government soldiers. Sky Wheeler is a Human Rights Watch researcher in Juba. She spoke with me about the recent use of child soldiers by both the government and opposition.
Last Friday, there was an attack on a town called Bentiu, which is the capital of South Sudan's oil-producing Unity State, by the opposition forces against the government, which is still controlling most of that town. And large numbers of civilian women fled from the town to the UN base, and many of them told us that they saw child soldiers being used by the government defending the town. We also saw child soldiers ourselves when we were in the town, and multiple observers from humanitarian agencies, the UN, you know, many different observers. Everyone has seen them. They're being used openly by the government in these towns for the last several weeks. And kids that we spoke to also said that, you know, they and other children had been posted out to defend areas around the edges of the town for the last few weeks as well.
So then this is going on despite South Sudan's 2008 Child Act, which forbids the use of child soldiers. In addition, they are also breaking international law.
They are breaking international law. It's also a war crime to use children under the age of 15, and at least some of these children are 15 and younger. It's very sad because South Sudanese Army, which, as you know, became a national army in 2011 when South Sudan became independent, before that was a rebel army, have actually taken considerable strides over the last few years getting rid of their child soldiers, releasing them, demobilizing them out of their armies, and getting them back home with their families. We're actually getting quite close to having a child-free army. So this is a real step back, actually. We should also make it clear that there are many very credible allegations. We know that child soldiers are being used by both sides. It's not just the government forces. There have also been the use of child soldiers by the opposition and their allies as well.
What is the government saying about their use of child soldiers?
They have different responses. I mean, people on the ground or people who are closer often say that, you know, the children come looking for work, and that is true. Some of them. There are also cases of forced recruitment. At the top level, there is acknowledgement that this is a practice that shouldn't be happening. And the government did sign a recommitment with the UN earlier this year to prevent the recruitment of child soldiers and ensuring that schools are not occupied and that any child soldiers are released from the army. So at that level, at least, we've seen a commitment to ending this practice, but we would like to see that commitment follow through with action on the ground.
What needs to be done to stop it?
The leadership, the government and the military leaders need to put out orders and make it very clear to their commanders in the field that the use of children in the army for any purpose, not just for fighting, but also for upper duty, is completely forbidden and must be stopped. They could also establish monitors to people who can work with the UN to release the children who are with the army now. And we need to also see the international pressure on both sides, not just on the government, but also on the opposition, to end this abusive practice.
Wars and conflicts are just very, very devastating. How is this particular conflict affecting the children there?
Of South Sudan's population is children. It's a very young population. And kids have suffered horribly in this conflict. The humanitarian situation in South Sudan is devastating. You know, the 1.5 million people displaced from their homes, people living in horrible conditions in IDP camps. For example, in the town of Bentiu itself, in Malakal, like living in flooded areas, water up to their shins. The medical humanitarian agency, Médecins Sans Frontières, has put out some information recently talking about children in Bentiu, in this town, where kids have been dying every day over the last few months. There's wars going on, there's battling going on. We've repeatedly seen in this conflict how civilians, including children, have been targeted and killed because of their ethnicity or their presumed allegiances. Despite all the kids face a very real risk of recruitment into one or both these forces.
That was Sky Wheeler, a Human Rights Watch researcher. She spoke with me from Juba, South Sudan.
An American foundation and a U.S. government agency have announced a new partnership, which has initial funding of $100 million, intended as a bold new vision for building resilience to disasters and other factors contributing to poverty across Asia and Africa. VOA correspondent Steve Herman in Bangkok has the story.
Data showing that one of every $3 spent on international aid during the past 30 years has been lost because of recurring crises is prompting a new initiative to break the costly cycles of suffering. The project is called the Global Resilience Partnership. Its co-founders hope that the initial financial commitment to it will soon double to $200 million, with help from governments, companies, and other stakeholders. The Regional Development Director in Asia for the U.S. Agency for International Development, Michael Yates, at a Bangkok news conference, explained that investments across sectors to make communities more resilient to disasters would help hundreds of millions of households.
We know that we can't stop typhoons and earthquakes, but we can certainly do a much better job preparing for them and helping people to bounce back far more quickly and far more robustly afterwards.
USAID is introducing the Global Resilience Partnership with the Rockefeller Foundation. The private organization's managing director in Asia, Ashvin Dayal, explains that the funders will seek ideas in a design challenge for solutions to build resilience that can be scaled for vulnerable communities.
What does a resilient person look like, or a resilient system, or a resilient community? And you start to understand it has some characteristics. For example, flexibility, the ability to adapt, some redundancy in the system so that you have choices, excess capacity, things like that. These, again, sound conceptual, but they are very real things, and they are choices about how you then invest in a community.
Examples of resilience projects include stone-resistant housing, crop insurance, and better access to weather information. The approach is receiving an immediate endorsement from a key agency of the United Nations. Fenmin Khan is the Asia-Pacific head of the UN Office for Disaster Risk Reduction.
We believe that this initiative is important because it recognizes that working with the private sector is an essential part of building resilience. And without the private sector, we cannot prevent new risks from being created.
Because of poor infrastructure and lack of resources, low-income countries suffer about half of fatalities from disasters, although they are hit by only 9% of such calamities. The Rockefeller Foundation and USAID warn that food insecurity and the effects of climate change are among the other factors that demand a new approach for building resistance to disasters. Steve Herman, VOA News, Bangkok.
The Sunni extremist group Islamic State ISIS claims in an internet video yesterday to have beheaded American freelance journalist James Foley in retaliation for U.S. airstrikes targeting the group's fighters in northern Iraq. VOA's Victor Beatty reports, although the United States could not immediately verify the authenticity of the video, the Foley family was among those paying tribute to the 40-year-old journalist's courage in the face of dangerous assignments.
The 40-year-old Foley disappeared November 22, 2012, after having been abducted by unidentified gunmen. In a video posted by the Islamic State titled Message to America, a person said to be Foley is wearing an orange outfit and kneeling in the desert as a masked man in black stands beside him holding a knife. The kneeling man calls on his friends and loved ones to rise up against the U.S. government.
My message to my beloved parents, save me some dignity and don't accept any meager compensation for my death from the same people who effectively hit the last nail in my coffin with their recent aerial campaign in Iraq.
The man in black identifies the kneeling man as James Wright Foley and denounces the U.S. government for being at the forefront of aggression toward the Islamic State.
As a government, you have been at the forefront of the aggression towards the Islamic State. You have plotted against us and gone far out of your way to find reasons to interfere in our affairs. Today, your military air force is attacking us daily in Iraq. Your strikes have caused casualties amongst Muslims. You are no longer fighting an insurgency. We are an Islamic army and a state that has been accepted by a large number of Muslims worldwide. So effectively, any aggression towards the Islamic State is an aggression towards Muslims from all walks of life who have accepted the Islamic Caliphate as their leadership.
Toward the end of the nearly five-minute video, another man in an orange outfit is shown and said to be another American journalist identified as Stephen Joel Sotloff, suggesting his fate rests with the next decision by President Barack Obama. A White House spokeswoman said U.S. intelligence is working quickly to determine the video's authenticity. If genuine, she said, we are appalled by the brutal murder of an innocent American journalist, and we express our deepest condolences to his family and friends. Foley's family in New Hampshire issued a statement on Facebook about his apparent death, saying they've never been more proud of their son and brother. He gave his life, they said, trying to expose the world to the suffering of the Syrian people, and they implored the kidnappers to spare the lives of their remaining hostages. His mother, Diane, said Tuesday, we thank Jim for all the joy he gave us. He was an extraordinary son, brother, journalist, and person. Marquette University, where Foley graduated in 1996, said it was deeply saddened by the apparent death of Foley. It said the history major had a heart for social justice and used his immense talents to tell the difficult stories in the hopes that they might make a difference in the world. Foley, who had also been briefly held by forces loyal to Libyan dictator Muammar Gaddafi during the 2011 uprising, has worked for the French press agency and the Boston-based online media outlet Global Post. His last dispatch from Syria for Global Post detailed the growing frustration with the war in Syria among Aleppo's population. Jonathan Edelman, associate professor at Corbell School of International Studies at the University of Denver, says this apparent execution is a response by IS to its recent setbacks on the battlefield.
To say, okay, we're not even going to concede that we can ever lose because we're, quote, infallible, but we now are going to go to the heart of the beast. We're going to go straight at the President of the United States and say, do you want us to slaughter this person? And it's incredibly appalling in the 21st century that any nation, any people would act like this.
Edelman says such brutality and battlefield setbacks may prove to be the undoing of the IS militants as other Sunni militant groups pull their support away. The New York-based Committee to Protect Journalists condemned Foley's apparent execution, saying the barbaric murder sickens all decent people. It said Syria has become the most dangerous country in the world for journalists to operate for the past 2 years, with at least 69 other journalists having been killed, more than 80 kidnapped, and 20 others who are currently missing. Victor Beatty, VOA News, Washington.
Thank you, Victor. And on a programming note, VOA is standing by for President Obama's remarks on the James Foley execution. We expect the president to be coming up shortly in our programming.
This is Africa News Tonight with Kim Lewis. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington. It's 29 minutes past the hour on The Voice of America.
On What's Happening Africa. This is Jackson Vunganyi right here in Washington, D.C.
And I'm Nadia Sami. Thanks for joining us. We love to have you on board. This is Upfront on The Voice of America. Hot.
Upfront is a show that explores issues
that affect your daily lives. Don't move that dial. Get your snacks, get your cup of tea or your cup of coffee. Put your feet up. This is Upfront. cheers. Clink, clink.
Yeah. Now there's a youth culture that is being practiced by the youth globally.
Yeah. I feel like
like the problem is that once the funds are sent to these developing countries, it sometimes gets in the wrong hands, and then it's the actual people that are supposed to be benefiting from these funds really never even get to see.
What does this mean for your local culture? Is it being threatened? Should your parents be worried? Let's talk. This is Upfront of the Voice of America. You can follow me on Twitter. My handle is at Upfront Africa. And remember, you can always send us an email here on the show. It's upfront@voanews.com.
This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. Here's a brief recap of our top stories this hour. Liberia quarantines two areas around the capital, Monrovia, and declares a nationwide curfew as authorities scramble to stop the spread of Ebola. And Human Rights Watch says South Sudan's army used child soldiers during recent fighting against opposition forces in violation of international law. Coming up, we have music from Burundi, and in our feature segment, the dire circumstances of refugees from South Sudan, the DRC, and Somalia. I'm Kim Lewis with Yehia Swuhi, and we're live from Washington. This is Africa News Tonight on the VOA. Sports with Sunny is next. Of course, it's time now for the sunny side of sports with Sunny Young. And happy Wednesday, Sunny.
Happy Wednesday to you, Kim.
Well, Sunny, I understand you're kicking off with kudos for Nigerian women's football.
Kim, let's kick off with a sunny side of sports salute to Nigeria's national under-20 women's football team, nicknamed the Falconettes. The Nigerian girls will play North Korea later Wednesday night in Moncton, Canada, where a berth in the FIFA Under-20 Women's World Cup final is at stake. The Falconettes are bidding for their first Under-20 World title. Their best previous performance was 4 years ago when they lost 2-0 to host Germany in the final. The German girls, whose senior male counterparts were crowned World Cup champions last month in Brazil, are bidding for their third women's under-20 world title in Canada. They also won the trophy in 2004, and they'll play France in Wednesday's second semifinal in Montreal, Canada. Getting back to the Falconettes of Nigeria, they seem to be flying high after a commanding 4-1 victory over New Zealand in the quarterfinals. That match was also played in Moncton, Canada. The Nigerian girls dominated the match from the opening kickoff, and Asisat Ashola scored only 32 seconds in, the second fastest goal in the history of the tournament. Ashola found the net again in the 12th minute. She also scored against England in the first round group stage, and she's Nigeria's leading scorer with 3 goals in the competition. The winners of the Nigeria-North Korea and Germany-France semifinals will advance to Sunday's title match at the Olympic Stadium in Montreal, the main venue for the 1976 Summer Games.
Kowalski for the Classic Rock Show, where each week we spotlight the great album rock and roll of the 60s, 70s, 80s, and beyond. You can hear the program online at voanews.com and on the air on VOA each Wednesday at 21 hours Universal Time. Join me for the Classic Rock Show, 21 hours Universal Time Wednesdays on voanews.com and the Voice of America.
If you were to talk to us from the deepest bitter part of the bottom of your heart... Hello, I am Shaka Sali, the host of Straight Talk Africa from the Voice of America. Each Wednesday night, I'll put you in touch with newsmakers and experts as they, you and I, talk about the most important social and political issues in Africa. Shaka Sali saying, I'll be waiting for your call Wednesday night on Straight Talk Africa from the Voice of America.
And my Voice of America colleague, Shaka Sali, will be waiting for you later Wednesday night at 18:30 UTC. With another edition of Straight Talk Africa. Now let's go to Vatican City in Rome, where Pope Francis smiled broadly Wednesday as he shook hands with players, coaches, and officials from his favorite football club, South American champion San Lorenzo from Argentina. Pope Francis has been a fan of San Lorenzo since he was a boy, and he looked delighted when the club presented him with the Libertadores Cup trophy during his weekly general audience at the Vatican. San Lorenzo lifted the cup for the first time in its 106-year history last week with a 2-1 aggregate win over Paraguay's Nacional Asunción. The pontiff spent several minutes holding the trophy before being presented with several red and blue club shirts by the players. Earlier this week, on a flight back from South Korea, Pope Francis talked about growing up in Argentina and said, and I quote, "San Lorenzo was the team all my family supported. My father played on San Lorenzo's basketball team, and when we were children, we sometimes went to the club stadium with my mother." Pope Francis showing his allegiance for San Lorenzo. World football's governing body, FIFA, recently released its monthly rankings for August. And one of the African teams that deserve a shout-out is Sierra Leone. So says our African football guru, David Legg.
For the first time ever, Sierra Leone are in the top 50 in the FIFA World Rankings. And congratulations to the coach, Johnny McKinstry, and to all the players of the Leone Stars. Despite all the problems in that country at the moment, and of course we wish them very well in their ongoing battle against this Ebola virus, Sierra Leone are now ranked 7 in Africa and 50 in the world. And if we look at the latest ranking, Sunny, the top 10, Algeria are first in Africa and 24th in the world, Cote d'Ivoire second and 25th, Nigeria are third in Africa and 33 in the world, Ghana, 4th and 36th, Egypt, 5th and 38th, Tunisia, 6th and 42nd. As mentioned, Sierra Leone, 7th in Africa and 50 in the world, Cameroon, 8th in Africa and 54 in the world, Burkina Faso, 9 and 58, and Senegal, 10 and 59. And then sadly, Sonny, for me personally, I've got to go down to position 14 in Africa to find South Africa, and they're ranked 69th in the world. But a big, big high five to the Sierra Leone team. That's a fantastic achievement to be in the top 50 for the first time. Well done to the Sierra Leone Leone Stars.
David, if we look at the very top of the FIFA rankings, the top three teams are Germany, Argentina, and the Netherlands, which coincidentally finished 1-2-3 at the recent World Cup in Brazil. Are those the world's top three teams, in your opinion, David?
I think so at the moment, Sonny. The Germans, of course, they've been among the best for a long time now. If we go back to the 2002 World Cup, second. The next two, Sonny, 2006, 2010, they were third. And now in 2014, of course, in Brazil, they emerged triumphant. So if you want to talk about the word consistency, and a consistency to be right up there near the top, there's no doubting that the Germans are in a league of their own. Argentina, they've underperformed actually at recent World Cups, but they finally came good in Brazil. And on another day, of course, they could have won the final. And they do have a certain striker, I think his name is Lionel Messi. He's a pretty reasonable footballer. If he'd been playing for the Germans, I think it would have been more than 1-0. And then if you look at the two semifinals, Sonny, I think there's no doubt at the moment that if you compare the Dutch with the Brazilians, the Dutch definitely come out on top. The Brazilians, of course, it just all came apart at the end of that World Cup, which they hosted. 7-1 defeat by Germany. I still to this day wonder, how did that ever happen at such an advanced stage of the competition? 7-1. That's like going back to the 1930s or 1950s when you had those sort of one-sided scorelines. But then in the third-place playoff, there was no rest for the Brazilians. They took a 3-0 drubbing from the Dutch. And it will, of course, Sonny, be interesting now to see how the Dutch fare under new management. Louis van Gaal, who was in charge in Brazil, has gone to Manchester United. And Gus Hiddink, who in 2002 was in charge of South Korea, in 2006 was in charge of Australia. He is now the new man at the helm. One thing about the Dutch, to have this habit of going up and then dipping down. So particularly interesting will be to see how the Dutch fare in the forthcoming qualifiers for the Euro 2016.
Thanks, David. That's our African football guru, David Legg, speaking with us once again from Johannesburg, South Africa.
Voice of America.
I'm VOA's Sonny Young in Washington, and you're listening to the sunny side of sports on The Voice of America. Now let's go to Sweden, where some of Africa's top athletes will be in action Thursday in an IAAF Diamond League meet in Stockholm. Kenya's African and Commonwealth champion in the javelin, Julius Yego, the subject of a recent Sunny Side of Sports blog post, is expected to face stiff competition in Stockholm. The field also includes reigning Olympic champion Keshi Walcott from Trinidad and Tobago. Keshi made history 2 years ago in London, where he became the first black male athlete to win a gold medal in a throwing event in the history of the Olympics. Reigning world javelin champion Vítězslav Veselý from the Czech Republic will also compete in Stockholm, and so will Egypt's Ihab Abdulrahman El Said, who has this year's best distance in the javelin, 89.21 meters, which he achieved about 3 months ago in Shanghai, China. Turning to the track in Stockholm, Nigel Amos, Botswana's Olympic silver medalist, as well as the African and Commonwealth champion at 800 meters, will be racing on Thursday, as well as Kenya's Asbel Kiprop, two-time world champion at 1,500 meters. The world indoor champion at 1,500 meters, Ayanle Suleiman of Djibouti, will also be testing his speed in Stockholm. Suleiman edged Kiprop for the gold medal at the recent African Championships in Marrakesh, Morocco. Follow the Sunny Side of Sports on Facebook and Twitter. My Facebook address is facebook.com/VOA Sunny, and my Twitter handle is @VOA Sunny Sports. If you go to my Facebook page today, you'll see a photo of Pope Francis holding the Libertadores Cup trophy at the Vatican. I'm VOA's Sonny Young, and that's the sunny side of sports. Back to Yahaeus Wuhib and Kim Lewis.
Thank you, Sonny. And listen to the sunny side of sports Monday through Friday at 1631 UTC and 1831 UTC. And on Fridays, Sonny has an expanded half-hour edition of the sunny side of sports at 1730 hours UTC right here on The Voice of America.
Coming up at the University of Texas Medical Branch, trying to come up with a vaccine to fight the Ebola virus. And next, the dire circumstances of refugees from South Sudan, the Democratic Republic of Congo, and Somalia. But first, some music. Here is Kidum from Burundi with Abambuzi.
Om Dapere, Gango Yusufu Matoma, Yahya Hussein, Papa Grace, Charles Ogada, Digital Entertainment Promotion. Ah, Sesa, Mama Kibido, Maurice Oyano, Todie, Todie. Vamos a más y lloró.
pamba wisera kandi wajiwa mako itewe kesi namugusamara bitumwa kesi nikiyababu kamarongo mesi ineka bizosa ya amuwa ugasigara witoga wichuza kwesiyo menya kanura mushinga naye kanura mufasoni yisi sibinyigise abantu bundi batifina abambuzi ntabarabuse utera kesi utiteguye
Papa Grasa Wame maso kukusika mituna jawe
Kariyuki nungu
Kumera makabalu jambo mokondo razasi
Wirinde
Wirinde, wirinda bambuzi
Bambuzi, bambuzi nungu
Wirinde, wirinda basura, basura, basura
Mutko abiri yakuya
Muse wigeru ya yata
Mutko awe ni mana
Muse wigeru twanjwako
Numbiri sanchuti anje umugishu tangwa ni mana Babambuzi basa kwishi na kari barusenya suki busa Ulivyo rero noja mumu kono razusi Abiso saya pweni kuche kya kunye kanura musinga naye kanura mufasoni yisi siminyigise abantu bonu bakishina abamuzi tavara bafise abukera kesu titakuye
abukera abamuzi
akataretse kawagasema
wame maso kukusika mituna jawe
kandi kabiri karatsiko
mera makabantu jambo mokondo razasi
era hezo mwibuza
wirinde wirinda bambuzi
aho
wirinde wirinda basura basura basura
imitwe kirarira sikuza 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 Tambo kwe dengwe Tambo kwe marika
Kidum of Burundi with Abambuzi.
Well, Thomas Geisbert at the University of Texas Medical Branch in Galveston, Texas, is a scientist who focuses on diseases caused by deadly viruses like Ebola and Marburg. Dr. Geisbert has been awarded a $26 million grant from the National Institutes of Health to further his work on a vaccine that works in tests on monkeys and may be helpful in preventing the disease or treating humans who have been exposed to Ebola. Ricky Shryuk in Dakar spoke to Geisbert and has the story.
NIH is going to fast-track or develop a vaccine. There are four or five different vaccines now that can completely protect lab animals against Ebola. And my guess is it's one of the vaccines that NIH has been working on.
What has been stopping us from having a vaccine all this time? And why is it different now?
The problem and the challenges in the past has been there's a very small global market for an Ebola vaccine. So, you know, there really hasn't been a financial incentive for a large pharmaceutical company to make an Ebola vaccine.
It seems quite fast. It only took a few months to say, okay, we can have a vaccine in September that we'll be able to test.
I do think that certainly this outbreak, being the largest Ebola outbreak on record, has raised awareness. And I think certainly there's been an increased concern, and particularly in the United States. So I think that that has facilitated or enhanced the possibilities of developing a vaccine, or basically fast-tracking the process a little bit. I still think it's probably very optimistic to think that a licensed vaccine would be available that quickly. I think more likely, perhaps, a vaccine that could be used for compassionate use or, you know, in an emergency situation is perhaps more of what is being discussed.
When you say emergency in situation, do you mean right now people in Freetown and Monrovia and Conakry would be getting this vaccine?
I'm not necessarily saying or suggesting that. I think the idea of vaccinating different populations is controversial. I think a well-characterized vaccine that perhaps could be used for, you know, first responders or medical staff is maybe a place to start, but I mean, this is all speculation.
And how is your research going? Was it in March that you guys received new funding?
So on the 1st of March, we received a grant from the National Institutes of Health here in the United States to develop what we think are three of the most promising post-exposure treatments against Ebola. And we picked these three because they're the three that have shown the most success in protecting non-human primates against Ebola.
Is there any talk of using your treatments yet on any of the people who have come down with Ebola?
Yeah, I mean, certainly it had some increased awareness. There's been a lot of interest. And the whole issue of treating the cases is pretty complex, and I really probably shouldn't go into, you know, we have corporate partners, and I really don't want to go into any discussion on that. One of the vaccines that we developed, that it can either be used as a preventive vaccine or it can be used as a post-exposure treatment. So this vaccine actually can protect some monkeys against Ebola after exposure. This vaccine actually was used in a compassionate use situation back, I think, around 2010, where a worker in a laboratory in Germany had an accident with Ebola, and the vaccine was used as a post-exposure treatment.
Thomas Geisbart is the University of Texas Medical Branch in Galveston, Texas.
The UN High Commissioner for Refugees says refugee numbers worldwide dropped in the last 15 years, but those numbers have been rising in low-income countries. For example, the Democratic Republic of Congo had 400,000 refugees in 2012. 10 years later, there are 500,000 refugees. Mark Yarnell is a senior advocate at Refugee International. He spoke to VOA's Leonard Moudou about the dire circumstances of refugees from South Sudan, the Democratic Republic of Congo, and Somalia.
Well, we're trying to draw attention to the enormous needs of displaced people around the world. In addition to refugees, there's also people who are displaced internally. And while there's new conflicts and new sources of displacement, there's also some people who have been living in camps for up to 20 years or more. And so trying to share the diversity of challenges that are out there.
And we interrupt our regular programming and go live to President Obama at Martha's Vineyard, who was speaking on the execution of journalist James Foley.
And a friend. He reported from difficult and dangerous places, bearing witness to the lives of people a world away. He was taken hostage nearly 2 years ago in Syria, and he was courageously reporting at the time on the conflict there. Jim was taken from us in an act of violence that shocks the conscience of the entire world. He was 40 years old, one of five siblings, the son of a mom and dad who worked tirelessly for his release. Earlier today, I spoke to the Foleys and told them that we are all heartbroken at their loss and joined them in honoring Jim and all that he did. Now, Jim Foley's life stands in stark contrast to his killers. Let's be clear about ISIL. They have rampaged across cities and villages, killing innocent, unarmed civilians in cowardly acts of violence. They abduct women and children and subject them to torture and rape and slavery. They have murdered Muslims, both Sunni and Shia, by the thousands. They target Christians and religious minorities, driving them from their homes, murdering them when they can, for no other reason than they practice a different religion. They declare their ambition to commit genocide against an ancient people. So ISIL speaks for no religion. Their victims are overwhelmingly Muslim, and no faith teaches people to massacre innocents. No just God would stand for what they did yesterday and what they do every single day. ISIL has no ideology of any value to human beings. Their ideology is bankrupt. They may claim out of expediency that they are at war with the United States or the West, but the fact is they terrorize their neighbors and offer them nothing but an endless slavery to their empty vision and the collapse of any definition of civilized behavior. And people like this ultimately fail. They fail because the future is won by those who build and not destroy, and the world is shaped by people like Jim Foley and the overwhelming majority of humanity who are appalled by those who killed him. The United States of America will continue to do what we must do to protect our people. We will be vigilant and we will be relentless. When people harm Americans anywhere, we do what's necessary to see that justice is done, and we act against ISIL, standing alongside others. The people of Iraq, who with our support are taking the fight to ISIL, must continue coming together to expel these terrorists from their communities. The people of Syria, whose story Jim Foley told, do not deserve to live under the shadow of a tyrant or terrorists. They have our support in their pursuit of a future rooted in dignity. From governments and peoples across the Middle East, there has to be a common effort to extract this cancer so that it does not spread. There has to be a clear rejection of these kind of nihilistic ideologies. One thing we can all agree on is that a group like ISIL has no place in the 21st century. Friends and allies around the world, we share a common security and a common set of values that are rooted in the opposite of what we saw yesterday. And we will continue to confront this hateful terrorism and replace it with a sense of hope and civility. That's what Jim Foley stood for. A man who lived his work, who courageously told the stories of his fellow human beings, and who was liked and loved by friends and family. Today, the American people will all say a prayer for those who love Jim. All of us feel the ache of his absence. All of us mourn his loss. We keep in our prayers those other Americans who are separated from their families. We will do everything that we can to protect our people and the timeless values that we stand for. May God bless and keep Jim's memory, and may God bless the United States of America.
That was President Obama speaking from Martha's Vineyard on yesterday's execution of journalist James Foley.
Hello, I'm Douglas Impuga. Join me for Reporters Roundtable every Thursday at 17:30 UTC. We'll take an in-depth look at an African news topic important to you. We'll have African journalists and expert guests share their ideas on the topic at hand. So please plan to be with us every Thursday at 17:30 UTC right here on The Voice of America.
This is Africa News Tonight on The Voice of America on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz. Tune in to Africa News Tonight at 16 and 18 hours UTC, Monday through Friday. And with that, we wrap up this edition of Africa News Tonight. Up next, our VOA editorial. I'm Yehiyes Wuhib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis. And for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at www.voaafrica.com. And on behalf of our Africa News Tonight producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Nelson Lopez, thanks for choosing The Voice of America.
What's happening, Africa? This is Jackson Vunganyi right here in Washington, D.C.
And I'm Nadia Sami. Thanks for joining us. We love to have you on board. This is Upfront on The Voice of America. Hot, hot.
Upfront is a show that explores issues
that affect your daily lives. Don't move. Don't move that dial. Get your snacks. Get your cup of tea or your cup of coffee. Put your feet up. This is Upfront. Cheers. Clink, clink.
Yeah,
Now there is the youth culture that is being practiced by the youth globally. Oh,
yeah. I feel like the problem is that once the funds are sent to these developing countries, it sometimes gets in the wrong hands, and then it's the actual people that are supposed to be benefiting from these funds really never even get to see.
What does this mean for your local culture? Is it being threatened? Should your parents be worried? Let's talk. This is Upfront of the Voice of America. You can follow me on Twitter. My handle is at Upfront Africa. And remember, you can always send us an email here on the show. It's upfront@voanews.com.